So Paul Allen, co-founder of Microsoft, real estate mogul, serial entrepreneur, and enthusiast of many different passions, he had a particular passion project a few years ago. And I'm here with John Kessler, who most of you will know as the host of our All Blues program. And you did a story about this, right? What was it exactly?
Paul Allen was releasing an album, and it was, you know, marginally a blues rock album. And they contacted me as being the blues guy at KPLU, said, would you be interested in maybe doing a story on the release?
It's blues rock. Like, what was the music like?
He did something very smart, which is as an amateur, he surrounded himself with ace professionals, people like Joe Walsh and the Hart Sisters.
You actually talked to Ann from Hart, and what was the experience of a well-known musician working with an amateur musician who happened to have a lot of resources?
In the case of the Hart Sisters, I know they've been friends with Paul Allen for years, and she said something about, we spent a couple of days driving around Europe in Paul's submarine, you know, just very casually mentioned that in a conversation, and it's like, okay. And
His secret lair.
Yeah, well, you presumably, yeah. So I think there's some trade-offs. Yeah, you make a record with Paul Allen, spend a couple of days in the studio, and then, yeah, you get to ride around in his submarine for a couple of days. I'd do that.
So this is Sound Effect, by the way. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to KPLU, and I'm talking with John Kessler, who you might know from hosting KPLU's All Blues program, but you were on the other end of this, right? You were the professional musician working with the amateur musicians.
Right. I had a recording studio business for a couple of years. The professionals weren't coming to my studio. The people that were coming to my studio were the amateurs. And it was every genre. It could be country or gospel or punk, or I did opera. I did classical music. It is no, you know, amateurs exist in all genres.
So what was it like then being the professional in the room and trying to support these amateur musicians? Was it fun? Was it...
Generally, I would say it was fun. The thing about amateurs that I would have to say with every one of them were passionate about what they were doing. They absolutely believed that they were writing the best song ever, that this recording was going to transform their life. I mean, that was common to all of them. They were all dreamers.
As a professional musician, are you that passionate about every single project that you do?
No. I'll tell you, it feels really different. When I was a pro and you'd play on a Tuesday night for $35 because you really need $35, it's a really different feeling than playing on a Tuesday night for $35 when you just absolutely want to play. It's the only thing you want to do. It's like, wow, I get paid for this too? So I've been on both sides of it. And there is more joy, I think, maybe with the amateurs. The professionals, we got a job to do here. You know, and we have these standards that we've set for ourselves. Amateurs they're trying to set new standards for themselves.
Well, that's what we're going to be getting into this hour here on Sound Effect. It's Amateur Hour right here on KPLU. We're going to be thinking about some of the ways in which being an amateur can be thrilling and exciting, but also terrifying and often downright embarrassing, whether you're an amateur movie maker or musician or nuclear engineer. So we're going to be getting into that momentarily. I want to thank John Kessler, host of All Blues here on KPLU, for helping us get things underway. Thanks, John.
Oh, sure.
And the rest of you, stick around for Amateur Hour right here on Sound Effect. As we embark on Amateur Hour here on Sound Effect, we're going to start by rewinding back to the original Amateur Hour. And that's actually what this thing was called, the Original Amateur Hour Radio Show. This was one of the most popular broadcasts in the United States back in the 1930s and into the 40s. And it was out of New York, but it has this very particular connection to the Pacific Northwest. That connection is a guy named Edward Bowes, known to his audience as Major Bowes. He created the Original Amateur Hour, but he also helped shape Pierce County, Washington. That may sound strange, but Sound Effect's Kevin Kniestad has the story of how Major Bowes went from South Sound land developer to famous radio impresario and champion of amateurs everywhere.
Four great cars, Plymouth, Dodge, DeSoto, and Chrysler, again bring you your friend, Major Edward Bowes, and his original Amateur Hour.
Okay, to say Edward Bowes was a genuine entrepreneur would be a great understatement. He grew up in San Francisco in a poor family, and you could say he started his entrepreneurial lifestyle as a teenager, doing calligraphy for nameplates or invitations for fancy dinners or weddings. And as he got older, he continued to work for himself, but also capitalized from being in the right place at the right time.
San Francisco, a prospering metropolis in the year 1906, gay and festive just after Easter Sunday. Then, on April 18, at 5:14 a.m.
A massive earthquake followed by several fires devastated San Francisco. But from disaster, Bowes found opportunity. Within days of the earthquake, Bowes started buying up destroyed property around the city and eventually became a very wealthy man through his property development. But he didn't stop with San Francisco.
He had a fellow from the Pacific Northwest come down and talk about the rapid growth of Tacoma, Washington, and that it was the fastest growing city probably in the country at the time.
That's Blake Serena, an educator and city councilman in Faircrest.
And I believe the next day, he and a group of his investors left. It was October 18th of 1906, came up to Tacoma, Washington, and was shown around the city.
Bowes and the investors hopped on the streetcar, which went from downtown Tacoma all the way to Steilacoom.
And the last real big hunk of property left on that line was Faircrest. And when he saw the land that Faircrest was on, that's when he decided he would make his move and purchase the land that Faircrest is on today.
Okay, now a little background here. When Tacoma was awarded the bid in the late 1800s to be the terminus for the railroad line in Washington, there were some grand plans for the city. Michael Sullivan is a principal at Artifacts, a historical preservation company in Tacoma.
Charles Wright hired Frederick Law Olmsted, the great American father of landscape architecture, to do the first master plan for Tacoma. And the plan he came up with were all these curved streets and parks and, you know, beautiful odd lots and just a city like no other in the world in 1873.
The problem was Tacoma was growing too fast and developers had to settle for a simpler city design.
So that Olmsted plan is always this kind of mythic dream of what the city could have been. It really was kind of left up to Bowes to come along and complete, to execute, really, the kinds of ideas that Frederick Law Olmsted had.
And that's exactly what Bowes did. Blake Serena says Bowes, realizing those ideas couldn't be implemented in Tacoma, put them and his own unique ideas to use on his new land, which he called Regent's Park, later to become Faircrest.
Looked almost like a resort the way he had set it up. There were little gazebos that were set up, and they had their own zoo. They had a kangaroo and a couple of other animals there, and he made this, I guess, a utopian society that he wanted to create in Faircrest.
Bowes' fingerprints are all over what is now Faircrest, and he left his fingerprints around Tacoma, too. He built a hotel attached to the Pantages Theater, the Hotel Illington, named for his wife, the actress Margaret Illington, and the Bowes Building, which still stands on 9th and A Street in Tacoma, built out of very expensive Vermont marble. Eventually, Edward Bowes' interests changed. In 1910, he sold Faircrest and started buying up vaudeville theaters around the country,
which led him into becoming involved with the RKO Keith Circuit, which was the great vaudeville circuit.
That's longtime television producer Albert Fisher, who worked on the original Amateur Hour after it transitioned from radio to television.
And that became so popular that Major Bowes then went to New York City, and he built the grandest of all of the theaters in the vaudeville circuit, which was the Lowe's Capitol Theater on Broadway in New York City.
Eventually, though, vaudeville started to die out, so Bowes changed the Lowe's Capitol Theater from a vaudeville house into a movie theater. But attendance wasn't great at the theater, so Bowes came up with a variety of ideas to get people to come in, like giving away free dishware. And then he thought, why not an amateur night?
So he started having amateur night where he would host it, and then he realized, well, gee, I've also got this radio station, WHN Radio, and I'm always in need of programming. Lo and behold, this became the cornerstone of that radio station, and it became so popular that his good friend, General Sarnoff, who owned NBC, came to him and said, why don't we take this nationwide? And so in 1935, they did. They started broadcasting the Major Bowes Amateur Hour as a national radio show. And it was the most popular radio show in the history of broadcasting at that time.
And now, here is Major Bowes.
Good evening, friends. On this opening day of autumn, we spin our weekly Wheel of Fortune for the 236th consecutive time. Around, around she goes, and where she stops, nobody knows.
Okay, so think of the original Amateur Hour as kind of an American Idol of the 30s and 40s. Listeners would call in each week and vote on which amateur they think should win. And some of these amateurs got their first national exposure on the show.
The most famous one from radio certainly would be Frank Sinatra.
The man's got curly hair, calm. My teeth are pearly, and they also have pearly teeth.
And indeed, they not only won, they became three-time winners. And I think that was probably the first and last time that Frank Sinatra ever asked for a job.
I could rest up.
The Amateur Hour, also with Major Bowes, discovered a lot of very famous opera singers. The most famous would be Maria Callas, who was only 13 years old when she was on the show, and her father did not want her performing. And so she appeared on the show using her singing teacher's name, Nina Foresti.
Nina Foresti? Nina Foresti. All right, what do you want to sing?
Something of Madame Butterfly.
All right, go ahead.
There were just a whole slew of people from the radio era that became famous because of Major Bowes and the Amateur Hour.
And it wasn't just people who became famous. Major Bowes would leave his impression on the entire entertainment industry. Have you heard of the Gong Show?
In the old vaudeville houses, if an actor is bad on a vaudeville stage, they would do what was called give them the hook. Well, Major Bowes realized that on radio you couldn't hear the hook. So he developed the gong. And actually, I'm in my office here in Los Angeles, and I have that original gong of Major Bowes that he used on radio and then on television. And here, I'll play it for you. Here's the famous gong from the Amateur Hour.
The show began to suffer during World War II. Wartime telephone restrictions kept listeners from being able to call in with their vote, which was one of the biggest draws to the show, and radio news became more popular. Major Bowes retired from the original Amateur Hour in 1945 and passed away just 1 year later. But his impact is still very visible, be it on a small Pierce County town or in today's television talent shows. It's really hard to miss.
Let's see what the judges have to say. All right. Champion Tanya Burno receives 3 1/4 stars. Your challenger Britney Spears receives 3 3/4 stars.
The winner of American Idol 2005 is Carrie Underwood!
Until Thursday next, then, I thank you for Chrysler Corporation, its dealers, the amateurs, and myself. Good evening, friends.
Sound effects, Kevin Kniestad. You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. Gabriel Spitzer here. Today, it's Amateur Hour. And the beauty of amateurs is really their audacity. You know, they figure, I can be a drummer or a painter or a rock climber, and who needs training or 10,000 hours of experience or a degree in nuclear physics? So on that last point, you might not think of operating a nuclear reactor as a classic amateur pursuit, but that's exactly what Carl Grenninger did in the basement of his Federal Way house. He's an IT manager at Microsoft, you know, a computer guy, not a nuclear fusion guy, but he has that amateur's boldness, and he figured, why shouldn't I build a nuclear reactor if I want to? And he had another motivation, too. Carl really cares about science, and he cares about science education. So I talked to him for this story a couple of years ago, and he explained how, as he saw it, tight budgets and the fear of lawsuits have pushed all the fun, dangerous stuff out of high school science class.
The epiphany was I walked into a classroom and I saw a science teacher, and he had a string and a paper cup. And he says, well, we're studying physics. And I looked back at the kids and I saw the word lame tattooed across their foreheads. And I said, I could do better than this in my garage.
Grenninger decided to do exactly that. Now, this Microsoft IT manager doesn't have any nuclear engineering experience per se, but that didn't stop him from building a nuclear fusion reactor in his house. And inviting teenagers to help.
I mean, come on, a nuclear reactor. That has got to be the biggest buzz that you can take home to mom and dad. Is, hi, I'm over at this guy's garage and we're running a nuclear reactor. Fine, son, make sure you take out the trash.
Grenninger is a lanky guy in his white lab coat and glasses, a touch of mischief in his eyes. He has a flair for the dramatic. The reactor room is behind a hidden door disguised as shelving in his garage.
So here's the real McCoy.
This is the Farnsworth fuser. It's a kind of reactor that uses electricity to fuse molecules of a hydrogen isotope. It's about the size of a refrigerator.
The bottom part we got from NASA.
Carl bankrolled this thing himself. He didn't want to name a number except to say it's well into six figures.
Got it from eBay, brought it here.
The reactor looks pretty much exactly as cool as you'd expect. Shiny chrome, purple lighting. Lots of those little yellow and black radiation hazard signs.
We're raising the shield.
Behind the one-ton shield sits the actual reactor, which resembles a motorcycle engine. Inside, high voltage pulls molecules from all sides toward a point. Some of them slam together hard enough to fuse.
And that's pure plasma at about 300 million degrees Fahrenheit.
How hot is that?
It's actually hotter than the surface of the sun.
Come on, wait a minute. Can this thing really be legal? And even if it is it safe? Well, as for the first question, apparently so. Because the fuser doesn't use radioactive fuel, it falls under state regulations. Those are handled by the Office of Radiation Protection, which did pay Carl a visit once after a neighbor raised some concerns.
From a safety point of view, I was entirely satisfied very quickly.
That's Mike Brennan, a health physicist with the state. Visiting Carl's garage, he saw the safeguards, the shielding, the radiation dose meters everyone wears, and he concluded it was probably safer than a lot of the stuff in other people's garages, like, say, a welding rig.
I think that it is not only safe, but he's teaching safety, so a culture of safety is radiating out from his secret lab.
That's pretty crucial when you remember Carl isn't just running a reactor in a Federal Way cul-de-sac, he's inviting children over to play with it. 12 high school students meet every Friday at Carl's house, take in a physics lecture, and then get ready to fire up the reactor.
Right there is a high voltage dump to ground, and I'm assuming that somewhere back there is lurking the capacitor of doom. Yeah.
The students are a mix of boys and girls, MIT-bound seniors, and impressionable sophomores. If Grenninger has his way, some of these kids will restock the talent in America's nuclear industries, making advances in energy, nuclear medicine, and materials science.
Core team, everyone to your stations for system startup.
With white lab coats and clipboards, they get ready to start the 73-point activation process.
Verify neutron counter audio.
Verified. turn on roughing pump.
At one point, senior Raymond Mong walks in wearing a bright silver spacesuit, carrying a thermos of liquid nitrogen.
Okay, LN2.
So, you ever do anything like this in class at school?
Oh, no. In class, the most physics we do is bouncing rubber balls. This kind of experience is definitely priceless.
Stand by for X-ray.
Two students sweep the sides of the reactor with Geiger counters. Others monitor the grid at the fuser's core.
17,000 volts. Okay. Disable alarm.
The significance of this kind of work isn't lost on kids like Crystal, a 15-year-old from Auburn who's been with the group since seventh grade.
I am known as the youngest fusioneer.
Crystal says working on the reactor has shown her that stuff that in the classroom feels like grunt work, the math, the careful observation, it all really matters.
I'm going to be honest, as a seventh grader, I had probably the worst grades. And joining this group made me a 4.0 student. This group gave me a new way of learning.
Carl Greninger and his pet nuclear reactor live in Federal Way, Washington. So we did this story a couple of years ago, and I talked to him recently to get an update, and he says the program continues apace. They've added all kinds of new functions, including a cool touchscreen Starship Enterprise Star Trek-y interface thing that runs the reactor. He's really excited about that. They've also expanded their scientific inquiry into biochemistry using the reactor. So we're going to have links to a whole bunch of that information, as well as pictures of the reactor and of Carl, at our website, kplusoundeffect.org. It's Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Our theme this week is Amateur Hour. And I gotta say, few professions attract more committed amateurs than movie making, right? I mean, that's probably always been the case, but now we can all carry around pretty decent video shooting and editing gear right in our pockets, and so it's more tempting than ever. But the Northwest has a long tradition of amateur filmmakers who are doing a lot more than just dabbling. And so we've invited Courtney Sheehan to come in and tell us about a few of them. She's the artistic director of the Northwest Film Forum. Hey, Courtney, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
So you must watch a lot of amateur films in your job, is that right?
Hundreds and hundreds. Yes, that is my job.
So would you say that there is a difference between amateur and amateurish?
Yeah, I think it's a good distinction to make, and a lot of it is changing insofar as production values now can be a lot higher for a lot less money. So something can look better than it might be in terms of its substance when it comes to the story, the acting, the set design, things like that. There's all kinds of other aspects that can still really mark a film as amateurish.
That's interesting, because it used to be that you could tell an amateur film within a few seconds because of the quality of the image and the film stock and the edits and stuff like that. Now, all that stuff can look real slick, but you have to look a little deeper to know that it's not a pro.
This year at Sundance was the first time that there was a film shot on an iPhone, actually using an app that was developed here in Seattle.
Well, you've come up with a handful of really interesting films that kind of fit the bill, films done by local filmmakers who are amateur or sort of amateur, right? Kind of in the early stages of becoming a real filmmaker.
Yes, I would say that these are distinctively more on the amateur, not amateurish end of the spectrum.
So the first one you brought up is like a short narrative film. What's that one?
It's called Julia's Farm. It's directed by Sudeshna Sen, and she is actually a first-time filmmaker, so it's the first thing she's ever made.
What you do is file for life insurance on one of them.
But we'll go to jail.
You know your business, and I know mine. Why would we get caught?
It's about two women, one who's about to retire and one who's more college-aged, who are really good friends and further bond throughout the film through a kind of unusual series of events that culminates in a heist of sorts.
What do you like about this movie, or what interests you about it?
Two things. One is the background of the filmmaker herself. Sudeshna had previously been a high school teacher, actually, of Japanese language and literature. But she found herself constantly being pulled to try to incorporate Japanese films into her curriculum. And she found herself asking, was this really to help her students, or was it because she just wanted to be watching and making films herself? Hence the career switch. And so as an amateur, she made this film that is also about amateur con artists. And I just think it's fascinating to whenever there's a film that has two women characters that have a distinctive relationship, especially like this cross-generational friendship. It's just really rare to see in film.
All right. Well, that short film is called Julia's Farm by Sudeshna Sen. And then next you have another short, but this one a nonfiction film, a documentary?
Yes. So this is called Mayor of Ballard by Titus Richard. Titus is a videographer, but it's one of his first kind of documentaries that was inspired just by a community member that he knew in Ballard, this guy who is just kind of a staple of the neighborhood and a blacksmith. And the film is a really sort of stunningly shot and touching portrait of this guy.
I feel like sometimes we want things to be more profound than they actually are. And maybe the profound exists in our own mind's eye.
It is crazy beautiful. I mean, the visuals are really gorgeous and does not look at all like an amateur did it.
No. And his cinematographer for it is quite experienced.
And what did you find intriguing about this movie?
It captures this moment of change in Seattle that we have right now, the way that the neighborhood of Ballard is changing, evolving, transforming. And you see similar threads throughout all kinds of neighborhoods in Seattle.
There are still some very involved people in the community. But we're losing it as it grows because people are getting priced out. The people who make it a community can't afford to be here anymore.
Well, that movie is called Mayor of Ballard by Titus Richard, and it's a short documentary. And next we have a long, I guess you'd call it a feature-length film, almost, right? Mm-hmm. It's called Killing June by Isaiah Corey. What's that movie all about?
So Killing June is a 64-minute film about a woman named June who has a bucket list of items that she wants to cross off before killing herself in a week. So it's a really bold and stark premise, and it's actually a black comedy, so it's a very hard thing to pull off. But I was really impressed by the degree to which Isaiah, who's a first-time director, he has a background as a cinematographer, he really did. It's really effective and unique.
I guess it's hard for me to understand. Maybe I believe that no matter how deep the hole you've dug for yourself, there's always a way out. Always a way to escape your demons, other than death.
Courtney, I'm just curious. Well, what do you think amateurs bring to the table? You know, like what do they bring that somebody who's been doing it for their entire career or is trained in the more traditional venues that they might not bring?
A fresh perspective, new ideas, new visions, new voices. It's something that Northwest Film Forum exists to kind of foster. We are all about discovering emerging artists. And a lot of Seattle's most established and successful directors now started as amateurs in the scene, just kind of helping each other out, making movies together on the weekend with, you know, just someone's car and $30 for gas. And that's how amateurs grow into being the kind of well-respected artists that we all know and like.
Courtney Sheehan is the artistic director of the Northwest Film Forum. They'll be showing all the films we talked about at this year's Local Sightings Festival. You can find more information about that at our website, kplusoundeffect.org. You're listening to KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this week it's Amateur Hour on Sound Effect. And the truth is, we're all amateurs when we start something new, and that uncertainty can be really scary. But for Susie Lee, who's an artist and an app developer, it's exactly that wide open space where you don't really know what's going to happen next where she thrives. She spoke with Sound Effect senior producer Arwin Nix.
Susie Lee is a professional these days, professional artist, and the CEO and co-founder of the dating app Siren.
I'm a problem solver and someone who wants to hopefully leave the world a little bit better than, you know, where it was before.
She was almost a doctor. Well, she got accepted to medical school.
oh my God, my life is over, which is a horrible thing to think about when you think of going to medical school. But there was something about that process that felt not right to me. And looking back, I can say the idea of having a particular kind of path laid out in order to achieve success felt stifling.
And then she was a teacher for 2 years, teaching chemistry, a career she left because, again, she felt stifled. But then Susie found herself taking a ceramics class.
I would think it'd be a litmus test of a human being that anyone who has a ball of clay in their hand are like, meh, not into it. I'm like, ah, I don't think I understand you as a human being, because it's so primal. You know, you're holding this wet ball of clay in your hand and it has a certain kind of density and mass to it. It feels really alive and organic in a way. And what you start to learn is like the thing that's in your head and the thing that you're making, they're really far apart at first, but then the exercise is like how to start to bring those things together.
Lee fell in love with ceramics, love at first clay. But to become a professional in the art world, she still felt like she needed that outside affirmation. And so she found a path and followed it. Art school, having her first art show, her second, her third, getting her own gallery. And she could have stayed with ceramics, but Lee is a maker of things. She decided to try something completely different. She created a dating app.
So the way that I thought of Siren working was thinking about how you meet someone for the first time in real life. And what do you know about that person? Well, you see who they are, like physically, but you also kind of know approximately what age they are and whether or not you can banter about things. That's it. And that's all we do on Siren, is to say you have an age range, you see a couple photos of the person, but the most important part is these responses to these daily questions, which are like icebreakers at a cocktail party or a dinner party, where you're like, your answer is interesting and I kind of want to know more about you.
So give me an example. What are some of the questions?
So one question was, where does rain sound best? It was beautiful. And people responded in ways in which it suggested whether or not they were interested in like being outdoors, right? Or inside with a book. There was another one that was, what needs to be experienced in real life and not just on the screen? So someone said Shakespeare and hockey, but not at the same time. And like your response is exactly what I was like, oh my God, this guy's hilarious.
Yeah.
But not only that, if I started to think about why I like this response is because, you know, there was this sort of idea of like whatever high culture is and low culture, this idea of like the mind and something more physical. Hockey means maybe he was from the Midwest or Canada, which is for a North Dakota, and you're like, woo, that's kind of fun. And the fact that his response made me think of Shakespeare and hockey at the same time.
Do you feel like a pro in the app world the way you do in the art world?
I think that there's a lot of skill sets that I've imported from the art world to the app world. So one key aspect is being comfortable with uncertainty, and that I feel quite good at doing. And there's a lot of people who have maybe gone from Microsoft and then decided they wanted to start a company, and they're not very comfortable with this kind of uncertainty. And so for those ideas and for those areas, I do feel like, I'm an expert at this. I'm an expert at the I don't know kind of space. For other things that are much more complicated in terms of, you know, hey, do you have this business model or things like that? No, I don't. But I don't think anyone expects that. It's really to say, can you find the resources or the allies to help you learn? So in some ways, being that amateur is I think the definition in my mind is that you go from a mistake and learn from the mistake and do it better the next time.
Why do you care so much about it?
I think when I broke away from medical school, my partner at the time said something which always has stuck with me, which is he said, Susie, if you don't try the thing that you're passionate about, like it's a tragedy. And he meant it in a very global sense of saying there's so many people who can't even, you know, have a roof over their head. There's no way they can pursue a passion. But then there's also a group of people who have everything, you know, material-wise, but something about them either is driven by fear or just, I don't know what it is, and they don't know what they're passionate about. So if nothing else, like, I feel like the way that I eat and the way that I approach problems is the same. It's like, it's going to be with gusto, it's better be damn good, and I'm going to eat the whole thing.
I mean, you keep putting yourself in a position where you have to put yourself out there more and more and more. You go from being in medical school where you're training to fix others.
Right.
And then being a teacher where you're putting yourself out there in a different way. And then being an artist, which is putting yourself out there in a totally yeah. different way. And now you're doing this where not only are you putting yourself out there, you're creating a space for others to put themselves out there.
You're totally right.
Like, it seems like you are just amping up the level of vulnerability in the world step by step as you go along.
That's an interesting way of putting it, but you're right. I feel like there should be more spaces for that vulnerability, that's how we connect, right? Like, is that you have shared something of yourself that, you know, was, one or two layers in, and I did the same thing, and suddenly we find these commonalities through those vulnerabilities. And I think that's where I found the online dating space to be so dehumanizing, is that it never left any breathing space for vulnerability. But that when you keep doing it, then anytime you get kind of knocked down, you learn how to self-comfort and get yourself back up again. And so it's something where I think, you know, if I look at the last, 15, 20 years of my life, that would be the steady practice, was like, you know, getting knocked down, having the grounds, you know, fall apart underneath you and go, all right, either we can go into bed and hide under the covers, which is always an option, or we have to get up and still do shit. And if you keep opting into that, it becomes a practice. And so then that practice becomes a habit, and that habit becomes a part of you. And you're like, yep, okay, you're testing me again. I think I can do this now.
Susie Lee is co-founder and CEO of the dating app Siren. She spoke with Sound Effects senior producer Arwen Nix. You can see more of the community questions from Siren at our website, kplusoundeffect.org. Sound Effect comes to you from senior producer Arwen Nix and producer Kevin Kniestad. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. Thanks also to Nick Woog, who helped inspire our theme this week. This week, we welcome Sound Effect's two new interns, Warren Langford and Casey Hicks. They are not exactly amateurs, but we are looking forward to their enthusiasm and their fresh perspectives. So Sound Effect is on iTunes. You can find our free podcast there and take two lousy minutes to write us a quick review. Send your feedback to soundeffect@kplu.org and tweet at KPLU or at Gabriel Spitzer. Also, don't forget to send in your Northwest etiquette questions for our upcoming advice segment with Dick Stein. We will be back next week with stories of people who've had a change of heart.
They had me lay down, like, right away. And then they came in, like, a group of them, basically just said, you're in heart failure, like, bad heart failure. My blood pressure was up, my pulse was down, which means, like, you're on the verge of, like, shock and kinds of stuff.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is 88.5 KPLU.